dream state, one. The bioterrorism component of the event is launched with the covert release of a plague biological weapon during a sold-out performance at the Denver Performing Arts Theater on Wednesday, May 17th, 2000. Beneath such a scourge, all social forms disintegrate. Within 48 hours, hundreds seek medical attention with fever and cough. By Saturday, 780 cases of the plague are reported, with 123 dead. A public health emergency is declared. Once the plague is established in a city, the regular forms collapse. The virtual news network, VNN, informs the Denver public that an outbreak of the plague has occurred after a terrorist attack. The theater, like the plague, is a delirium and is communicative. By Sunday, thousands of panicked people flood hospital emergency rooms. 1,800 cases of the plague are reported in the US, London, and Tokyo, with 390 dead. The number of bodies in morgues reaches a critical level. Pyres are lit at random to burn the dead, soon followed by a general flight. Then the houses open, and the delirious victims, their minds crowded with hideous visions, spread howling through the street. On Monday, the public is advised to begin wearing masks. The healthcare system in and around Denver approaches collapse. State borders of Colorado are ordered closed. Civil unrest breaks out and sporadic rioting. Supplies of food are short. 3,000 cases of the plague are reported, with 795 dead. The plague takes images that are dormant and suddenly extends them into the most extreme gestures. The theater also takes gestures and pushes them as far as they will go. Like the plague, it reforges the chain between what is and what is not, between the virtuality of the possible and what already exists. By Tuesday, plague is reported in 11 states, with 3,700 cases globally and 950 deaths. Or maybe 2,000 deaths. There are now conflicting reports. Even destroyed, even annihilated, he knows we do not die in our dreams, that our will operates even in absurdity. He wakes up. On Tuesday evening, May 23rd, 2000, the first top-off simulation exercise is terminated. The analysis. The most terrible plague is the one that does not reveal its symptoms. Artaud, The Theater and the Plague, 1938. You could say that the state begins dreaming its own death in public and persuasive detail on June 14, 1954. This is the opening day of Operation Alert, a state-sponsored psychodrama of atomic attack, conducted each summer for 4 years during one productive peak of US Cold War innovations, including the new hydrogen bomb. For the first time in its history, colonial and post, the United States designs and enacts a simulated display of its potential obliteration. On Friday, June 15th, 1955, Ground Zero is incinerated in 60 US cities when 61 atomic bombs explode on their civilian targets. By the end of the day, the massive nuclear attack on the U.S. kills an estimated 8 million people and creates potentially deadly radioactive fallout over 63,000 square miles. Operation Alert, the nationwide civil defense simulation exercise organized in response to the attack, involves over 80 cities in 1955. In Youngstown, Ohio, the entire city, led by the mayor, evacuates. At the center of the deserted town, adding realism to the exercise, the 554th Explosive Ordnance Detachment detonates a mock bomb. As a nascent U.S. national security state turns to civil defense simulations to experimentally perform and operationally deter its own annihilation, we witness one historical, hallucinatory instance of national phantasmagoria that Joe Masco, following Walter Benjamin, invokes as, quote, a new techno-social context of modern life, in which a fascination with artificial environments was making access to the real problematic, end quote. A tactile technique of social control and state-sponsored dream work, the phantasmagoria of nuclear threat remains to this day a public secret whose tactical revelation, perhaps a brief, well-broadcast image of a mushroom cloud circulated by the U.S. National Security Advisor, provokes a nationalized fantasy of imminent extinction and aggressive self-defense. And yet quite a bit more and less may be at stake here than an increasingly problematic access to the real, as phantasmagoria becomes relentlessly networked to a reality it would both erase and reconstitute, really. In a cabinet-level meeting held during Operation Alert exercises in 1957, the U.S. Secretary of Defense reports that due to the realistic simulation of emergency government activities, people were panic-stricken in large cities and were paying no attention to government orders. Any solution to the emerging panic risked exacerbating the implosive mix of the real and the unreal, death and its preemption, effect and cause. A statement by the president clarifying the simulated nature of the operation might calm a panicky public, but be mistakenly interpreted by the Soviets as a sign of real preparations for war, potentially touching off a defensive Soviet nuclear offensive. The civil defense exercise could explode into a real war caused by the simulated preparations to defend against it. We're entering the field, hallucinatory and real, simulated and material, of psychopolitics. Let me tell you what I see. 20 figures in hazmat suits and oxygen masks move with a slow, ghostly gait among the hundreds of injured and dying. Emergency workers outfitted in military camouflage strap the wounded onto stretchers laid in neat rows on the bright, bright green grass. As plague ravages the imaginary and operational circuits of Denver and beyond, the town of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, is hit by a second terrorist attack. A bomb armed with mustard gas explodes in an abandoned van near the city's Port Authority. 51 people are dead. An estimated 200 are contaminated by the potentially fatal chemical. The simulated terrorist attack brings together 100 top officials, and so top off, the exercise's code name, from 35 state, local, and federal agencies, including the FBI, the Department of Justice, FEMA, the National Security Council, the CIA, and the Department of Defense. The $3.5 million top-off simulation, mandated in 1998 by a U.S. Congress increasingly anxious about the nation's vulnerability to bio-attack, reveals disturbing gaps in readiness at all levels of government response, from interagency communication systems to uncertain procedures for isolating, quarantining, or decontaminating target populations. With a curious urgency, the notion of biopolitics has recently swarmed through the fields of contemporary theory. And certainly, the top-off simulations participate in a biopolitical constitution of future present populations in the name of national preparedness and a new techno-social calculus of catastrophic risk management. But at the dark margins of sociology, in the daily, shimmering, electromagnetic spectrum of massively mediated images and information, it is psychopolitics that possesses me. In part conceptual kin to modern biopolitics, psychopolitics generates technologies for measuring and managing the psychic and emotional life of entire populations, the opinion polls, the psychopharmacy, the generalized circuits of therapeutic feedback and exchange. But psychopolitics also stretches a bit crazily beyond the logics of discourse and disciplines. Psychopolitics works somewhat psychotically to refuse and confuse the shifting, always social boundaries between the real and the unreal, between violence and its simulation. The unreal is no longer that of dream or of fantasy, writes that insistent ethnographer of psychopolitical delirium, Jean Baudrillard. It is that of a hallucinatory resemblance of the real with itself. Psychopolitics approaches something about which Michel Foucault had too little to say: the contemporary entanglements of power knowledge with the rise of 20th century image and information technologies, the electrified networks of miniaturized surveillance and nano-paranoia, the vertiginous cascades of capital, the automated mediascapes of code. Psychopolitics plays seriously in that perhaps maddening realm where state power deploys both reason and phantasm, both rationales and waterboarding, sciences and fictions, all as tactical players in productions of perception itself. The problem of writing against terror, writes Michael Taussig, might be addressed through the dark fictions of that ambivalent storyteller, Joseph Conrad, who writes of the New World Order space of death that the trick is to penetrate the veil while retaining its hallucinatory qualities. The trick of writing toward and against terror's trickery may be to come up with our own set of tricks, simulations, deceptions, art, or appearances. The trick of writing effectively toward and against bioterrors today may be defined in the psycho spaces of simulation, traces of our own shimmering real.
We'll tell you a lot more about them tomorrow. They are the men that they would most like to find. Now, the question that sits in front of us is, how high will the numbers go, the number of people who are exposed to the plague bacteria? The government says it is under control, but we have been seeing these numbers increase dramatically. It went from 92 to 816, and now standing at 2,150 dead. That is a dramatic increase. The question that we ask, is there something that we don't know? Is there something that we don't know? Is there something that we don't know?
Dream state 2. The attacks are relentless, imaginative, repetitious, traumatized. The future refuses to stay in place. The past holds tight in a fierce play for more time. Enemy forces are set free. In the spring of 2003, they explode a dirty bomb packed with radioactive material in an industrial area of South Seattle. At an uncanny ground zero of smoldering vehicles and dazed victims, a giant plume of toxic smoke drifts toward the city. The next day, a mysterious ailment appearing in emergency rooms in Chicago turns epidemic. They've attacked the city with pneumonic plague. April 2005. They fly a small beach aircraft outfitted with a crop duster over New London, Connecticut, dispersing aerosol mustard gas. As emergency workers attend to casualties on the ground, a vehicle-borne improvised explosive device goes off outside a first aid tent. Simultaneously, in nearby New Jersey, a plague epidemic is launched out of the back of an SUV on the campus of Keene University. The driver of the SUV, Fatima Barikad, a PhD microbiologist from Paris, whose husband was killed fighting jihad in Algeria, is in custody, but not cooperating. And then, in October 2007, they attack on three fronts at once. Three radiological dispersal devices explode in Portland, Phoenix, and the U.S.-occupied territory of Guam. The analysis. To all Americans, let me be very, very clear. This is a simulation. This is a test. The attack is not real, but the response will be as realistic as possible. Tom Ridge, news briefing for Top Off 2, May 2003. Thus is uncertainty organized everywhere. Guy Debord, 1990. After the attacks of September 11th, 2001, Top-Off simulations are administered as a biennial national event organized by the new Department of Homeland Security. Designed to reveal vulnerabilities in emergency response to a range of catastrophic incidents, Top-Off has been catapulted since May 2000 from bureaucratic obscurity to a central role in Homeland Security's elaborate five-year national exercise program, with a $25 million budget for Top-Off 4 in 2007. Enacting a hyperactive theater of simultaneous triple terrorist attacks, Top-Off 4 also inaugurates joint military-civilian simulations with the Department of Defense, which runs secret, concurrent exercises. While the organizational ambition and federal resources devoted to the exercises are without historical precedent, Top-Off simulations can be usefully situated in a post-World War II history of the psychopolitics of scenario planning. Emerging out of the catastrophic threat of nuclear war and the unthinkable future it conjures, scenario planning was developed in the early 1960s at the Rand Institute by Herman Kahn. Scenario planning was the method for imagining, in compulsive operational detail, a nuclear-devastated future. Imagination, Kahn writes in 1962, has always been one of the principal means for dealing with the future, and the scenario is simply a device for stimulating and disciplining the imagination. Scenario planning promised nuclear war planners a synthetic experience of events, fabricating future history through anticipatory catastrophe. And what do Top-Off simulations promise the planners of imagined bioterrors today? What forms of synthetic experience were generated in the most recent simulation held over a 9-day period in the fall of 2007 with over 15,000 participants plus private sector corporate partners? What future histories are being fabricated through the rationalized, traumatized preparations for bioattack? If the spreading plague for Artaud was a scene in which all social forms disintegrate, how today has plague simulation become a productive site where new techno-social forms of life are built? What is being built today on the simulated grounds of Top-Off exercises consists in part of a comprehensive, integrated, multi-scalar systems architecture for managing the effects of catastrophic disaster. Borrowing the standardized equivalencies of FEMA's framework of all hazards planning, where earthquake, nuclear accident, the plague, and severe flooding circulate on a shared, discursive plane. The Department of Homeland Security has designed a layered series of operational procedures for what are now calmly termed incidents of national significance. In 2005, scenarios for the top-off simulations themselves are standardized into a design template of 15 different threat scenarios, including plague and anthrax attacks, perpetrated by a universal adversary, UA. If top-off exercises can be clearly seen in light of a preparedness rationality informed by contemporary technologics of security, they might also be situated, perhaps even experienced synthetically, within a less rationalized, more suggestive, and no less strategic psychologics of simulation. Melinda Cooper's analysis of scenario planning as a technique for speculative futures methodologies helps point the way into the imaginary materialities at play here. As a state-sponsored, post-September 11th illogic of preemption finds its way from military to civilian fields, we witness the spreading assumption that the only way to survive the future is to become immersed in its conditions of emergence, to the point of actualizing it ourselves, compelling us to become the uncertain future we're most enthralled to. In a temporary psychosis, not unlike that of a panic attack, when an anticipatory terror implodes toward the present certainty that death has already arrived, and you live, strangely, in death's aftershocks, gasping for air in the effort to grapple with the news. The psychologic of simulation calls the future into the present in a preemptive move to experience synthetically while persuasively surviving its terrifying uncertainty. The benefits of such a psycho-strategy of schizoid temporalities are real. Preemption, writes Brian Masumi, does not prevent, it effects. It induces the event in effect. Rather than acting in the present to avoid an occurrence in the future, preemption brings the future into the present. The event's consequences precede it. The present reality of its effects mean that it can be responded to pragmatically, all the while remaining virtual. The virtual materialities of simulation preempt an uncertain future into the twisted temporality of a future present that can be realized, managed, and manipulated. Simulation's effective and affective trajectory of consequences now include the experience of a terrifying future, affectively modulated by the trick of its effects being incorporated in advance. Affect is an effective mechanism of operational linkage. Future time, present time. Simulation stages a scene in which the future operationally generates the present, a present increasingly armed and ready for the disasters it lucidly, systematically dreams. Bioterror, biosecurity, the operational linkages abound. The ESP Group, Incorporated, understands Brian Masumi's theoretical point with a pragmatic, entrepreneurial ease. A Virginia-based private security company, the ESP Group produces for top-off exercises in 2003 a secure, internet-accessible communications platform for coordinating situational awareness between federal agencies, the local police, and emergency responders. As 8,500 simulation participants attempt to manage the explosion of a dirty bomb in Seattle and a plague attack in Chicago, ESP's encrypted communications network supplies top-off players with secure, real-time information-sharing capability. 4 years later, the ESP Group's parent company is awarded a $6 million Homeland Security contract for the secure portal technology enabling internet-based circulation of controlled, unclassified information. The internet communications technology rehearsed during Top-Off 2 is today the platform for the Homeland Security Information Network, an electronic, intelligent sharing infrastructure that now supports over 40 state fusion centers, new command and communication centers dedicated to fusing data produced by local police, homeland security agencies, private corporations, and counterterrorism units. The ESP Group mobilizes the effects of bioterrorist simulation not as a rehearsal for future events, but as a preemptive production of real future present events constituted in advance as security threats. A simulation is woven into the technical practices of a society as the virtual form of their development, writes William Bogard in 1996. In 2009, as new communication and surveillance technologies emerge out of the systematic phantasms of Top-Off, what simulacrum of power is at work? What virtual order of perception, what imaginary of surveillance does society dream with today? In 2005, after Top-Off 3 exercises stage a plague epidemic in New Jersey, the Center for Disease Control, for reasons never publicly announced, merges its two-year-old BioSense program with Homeland Security's new BioWatch surveillance system, assembling public health and national security data into a shared information architecture. BioSense is a software system that signals algorithm-generated alerts for potential bio-incidents. BioWatch deploys biosensors in the atmosphere to test for a mass pathogen release. It's currently deployed in at least 31 unspecified U.S. cities. The BioSense BioWatch assemblage becomes a centerpiece for a $274 million Homeland Security project described as the nation's first system providing integrated biosurveillance for a biological common operating picture, BCOP, for the world. But what exactly is being watched here? What are the logistics of perception built into this technological simulacrum of real-time situational bioawareness? The biopolitical dream of population health seems strangely incidental to what Lyle Fernley calls vital systems security for the political and economic order itself. The target of BCOP biosurveillance is not exclusively the national health. In fact, the health and disease patterns of a statistical population become a data source for signaling biothreats to the bios of vital systems. Under BCOP, Fernley explains, the signal prompting intervention is no longer based on an abnormal fluctuation in a population's health. Rather, the abnormality prompting intervention is modulated by threat assessments provided by intelligence agencies. The psychologics of perception at work here create a kind of second-order simulation of the social, constituted by the operational performance of its own vital systems, the economy, law enforcement, and military defense. Is this why top-off simulations today so tightly script the participation of the media. In contrast to Cold War Operation Alert exercises, when mass media coverage of the event was widely promoted, during top-off exercises today, the media primarily appears inside the system of simulation itself. VNN, the Virtual News Network coverage, is scripted into each top-off simulation scenario, and exercise participants watch and are watched by the single simulated news channel producing web broadcasts 8 hours daily during the exercises. In a kind of delirious empiricity, a virtual actual interface is created between fake, scripted news reporters interviewing real rescue workers, terrorism experts, and military officials who talk about their synthetic, simulated experience of bioterror. The VNN broadcasts are then watched by officials participating in the exercise, creating live feedback relations between virtual media and the real-time simulation event. A permanent VNN website exists on the internet without mention of its role in top-off simulations, with updated links to real news. Dream State 3. The weaponized smallpox is released into shopping malls in 3 U.S. cities: Philadelphia, Atlanta, and Oklahoma City. As people across the country begin to sicken and die in alarming numbers, vaccine distribution efforts are chaotic. Public unrest grows as the existing supply of vaccine is exhausted. The National Security Council urgently meets and is informed that an associate of Osama bin Laden has been arrested in Russia, trying to purchase weaponized biological pathogens. Credible intelligence also points to recent Iraqi efforts to reconstitute its biological weapons program. Satellite images of a suspected bioresearch facility outside of Samarra reveal suspicious activity. Then, 3 anonymous letters sent to national distribution newspapers demand that all U.S. forces withdraw from Saudi Arabia and all U.S. warships from the Persian Gulf. Each letter contains a smallpox sample with a genetic fingerprint matching the strain unleashed in the terrorist attack. It is June 2001, and we name our simulated bioterrors Dark Winter, not knowing how dark the winter of 2001 will truly be. Or do we? For who knows what we really know in such dark and disoriented dream states?
I'm a doctor in central Manchester, and as people might be aware, they've estimated that there's an excess of 98,000 deaths in Iraq that have occurred since the invasion of Iraq started. And I'm sure when people have been watching the television over the last few days, the horror of what's going on in Fallujah is something that I've certainly found. It's that strange situation with the news. Many of us, I'm sure like I am, when you watch the news, you're trying to work out what the truth is, because we know we don't always get the truth, or sometimes we find the truth out later. When you think about the 30 million people who marched on the weekend of February the 15th, all of those millions of people are watching Fallujah, and that's what the difference is we're all watching, trying to interpret it, and trying to work out what's going on.
The analysis. Quote, "The secret is a public secret, being that which is generally known, but cannot generally be articulated. This is not a question of seeing more, or seeing less, or seeing behind the skin of appearance. Instead, it turns on seeing how one is seeing. Whatever magic is, it involves this turn within the known unknown. And what this turns on, a new attitude towards skin." End quote. Michael Tosic, 2003. Is there something that we don't know? Forrest Sawyer, news anchor, VNN broadcast, top of three. The anthrax arrives in the mail, targeting U.S. senators and the corporate media. But it is the mail workers who die, caught laboring in the transmission routes of an always non-random contagion. The anthrax letters, sent in the weeks just after the attacks of September 2001, constitute the most significant bioterrorist incident ever carried out in the homeland. Each letter contains a fine, dry powder of highly concentrated weaponized anthrax, enclosed in a photocopied note stating, "Allah is great, death to America, are you afraid?" By 2009, it is a tremulous public secret that the bioweapon in the attack was the anthrax strain most commonly used in U.S. bioweapons research, that the anthrax originated from Fort Detrick, Maryland, the birthplace of U.S. biological warfare research, in 1942, and that the anthrax letters were produced and sent by a U.S. bioweapon scientist. It is less known, perhaps, that the design of the anthrax attacks appears to simulate key features of the simulation scenario for Dark Winter, a bioterrorism exercise carried out at Andrews Air Force Base in June 2001. Organized by several U.S. biosecurity and counterterrorism centers, Dark Winter simulates three National Security Council meetings held as the nation faces a smallpox attack linked to a secret Iraqi biological weapons program and to Iraqi-backed terrorists working for Osama bin Laden. In July 2001, 1 month after Dark Winter exercises and 2 months before the anthrax letters arrive in the mail, the U.S. government rejects an agreement that would have strengthened the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention Treaty, which outlaws offensive biological weapons programs. News reports in early September 2001 suggest that the U.S. government walked away from the strengthened treaty out of concern for the status of its own secret bioweapons program. What program is that? That program, as reported in the New York Times on September 4th, 2001, includes CIA field testing of a germ bomb modeled after a Soviet-designed bioweapon, a Pentagon attempt to mimic terrorist activities by building a bioweapons factory in the Nevada desert from commercially available products, and a CIA-backed project to genetically engineer a virulent antibiotic-resistant strain of anthrax. Is there something that we don't know? If the public secret, that principal arm of statecraft, is strangely re-enchanted by the occasional revelation of its contents, gaining in magical force, even as it briefly drops its mask to reveal a complicitous theater of unmasking, then what might be an adequate response to the revelations entailed in the wake of the anthrax attacks? Were the anthrax letters a technique of bioterror, or something more elusive, even more terrifying? A simulation of bioterrorism carried out in the interests of exercising and intensifying the vital systems of U.S. biosecurity. If the anthrax letters have been revealed, really, as an attack of biosecurity, conducted and strategically conceived from within the belly of the national security state, then what would it take to counter such an intimate, such a psychotic enemy? What would it mean to inoculate ourselves from future contagious transmissions of state-sponsored terror delivered over and over and over again, behind the mask of national defense. Since the 2001 anthrax attacks, the state, while regularly rehearsing the possibility of its own bio-annihilation, has also spent close to $50 billion to address the threat of bioterrorism, including the ambitious design of a new Homeland Security biodefense complex. A nationwide network of military, corporate, academic institutions still under construction. The biodefense complex includes 10 new university-based regional centers of excellence, where member institutions work to develop next-generation treatments and diagnostics for plague and other biothreats. But the center of the nation's biodefense complex is the expanding campus at Fort Detrick, Maryland, where a new bioforensic analysis center for developing the cutting-edge techniques used by the FBI to trace the genetic fingerprint of the anthrax letters back to Fort Detrick is being built at the site of origin of the most deadly bio event to date in the United States. Is there something that we don't know? Or is there something that we know already that remains still secret, even to ourselves? Does the psychologic of the public secret really require us to learn more? Or instead, does it call us to turn back on the skin of the secret, the synthetic surface of events where, with our own tricks, simulations, art, and appearances, we can perform something like a creative sabotage of the future, even as it comes toward us in a terrified preemption of possibilities. The state may be learning that it can die in its dreams, that a psychopolitics of bioterror spins vertiginously into and out of the same dream state of so-called security. Do we already know enough to dream elsewhere, of other scenes? Is knowledge here in these dream scenes of our somewhat psychotic state perhaps not the only or the most important escape route? What other forms of movement might make a critical difference to the psychopolitical play of terrors bound to reappear in a prescripted and uncertain future tense.